Thank you. I'm glad to see that we're at least coming a little bit closer. The seats in the back are no less expensive than the seats in the front. Okay, so we were talking about Jacob. And last week we had gotten to a kind of a crucial point, but just to recap. Jacob and Esau were born to Isaac and Rebekah. Jacob was born holding on to Esau's heel, and that's why he was named Jacob, because Yaakov in Hebrew means heel, physically. But it also has the connotation of the same as, it's somewhat of a negative connotation, just as it is in English. If somebody's a heel, that's not a very complimentary thing to say. Jacob, the episodes that were told of Jacob's life, he spent all his time trying to get ahead of his brother. He didn't steal the birthright, but he certainly took advantage of his brother's weakness to trade for the birthright for a bowl of stew. And then he and his mother When Rebekah heard Isaac telling Esau that he wanted to give Esau a blessing, Rebekah interpreted that as being the covenant, that Isaac was going to pass the covenant with God on to Esau. And she knew that this couldn't happen because she had received a prophecy earlier that said the older will serve the younger. She knew that what she thought Isaac wanted to do was wrong. So rather than approach him with this, she came up with a scheme where Jacob would pretend to be Esau and get the blessing. Jacob, rather than objecting to the lack of morality in the plan, his only concern was that he would be caught. But Rebekah said, "Your curse be on me. I take responsibility. Just go do as I say." So he did it, and he lied to his father, took advantage of all the deceptions that Rebekah had devised, and got the blessing. And the blessing that Isaac gave him was not the blessing of Abraham. It was more a local blessing that repeated the prophecy that Rebekah had received, that your mother's sons will bow down to you. So he made Jacob gave Jacob power in the family. When Esau came back, he found out what had happened, and we had a large discussion as to whether Isaac was really fooled by this deception or not. There are good reasons to think he was, there are good reasons to think he wasn't, but whatever it was, he blamed Jacob when Esau reproached him. And Esau says, Have you only one blessing? Please bless me too, Father. So Esau, being a headstrong guy, said that as soon as their father died, he would kill Jacob. He would take revenge. So Rebekah, the strong person that she is, she tells him to go back to Haran, which is where she came from, where her family is, and stay there until Esau's fury subsides. And then she says she will send for him and bring him back. So he does this, and on the way out, he has this dream of the ladder, Jacob's ladder, where angels are going up and down, and God makes several promises to Jacob. God promises to protect him. God promises to make his people, his descendants, numerous. And God promises to give his descendants the land where the Canaanites are living, which is the blessing of Abraham. So it appears as though all that deception that resulted in this his exile was unnecessary, because the decision is really God's, not Isaac's anyway. So Jacob goes back to Haran, and he connects with Laban. I don't know if I told you this. Laban in Hebrew means white. And don't know whether that meant that he was light-haired in a setting where most of the people were dark-haired, or whatever it may be. Don't know what that means, but it does. Laban means white. And we met Laban before when Abraham sent his senior servant to Haran to get a wife for Isaac. And at that time we learned that Laban is interested in money. So when he hears that that Rebekah's son is there, his own nephew, he's obviously very interested, and the implication is that he is interested. He expects that Jacob is going to be bringing gifts, just like the servant did in the last generation. But of course, Jacob is penniless. He explains his whole situation to Laban, and Laban says to him, "You're truly my bone and flesh." So here we set up a confrontation between two people who, I don't want to say like to, their primary mode is deception. Jacob never confronted his brother, and Laban doesn't like to confront either, but he does use deception as his tool. So we're in chapter 29. And I'll go back a little bit from over what we had finished with last time. And in the middle of verse 14, it says, "When Jacob had stayed with Laban a month's time, Laban said to Jacob, 'Just because you're a kinsman, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me what shall your wages be?'" This sounds like a very nice thing. Okay, I'll pay you. But what Laban is really telling him, "You've been here for a month as a guest. Well, you're going to have to work for your keep. You can't expect to sit around here doing nothing." But he says, what will your wages be? And Jacob, who loves Rachel, offered to work for 7 years to marry his younger daughter, Rachel. He was quite explicit about this. I'll work for 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban agrees, and the 7 years aren't even discussed. He says they passed, seemed to him, but a few days because of his love for her. Then in verse 21, Jacob says to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her." Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah, the older one, and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her. And when morning came, there was Leah. And we talked a little bit about how this could have happened. There's some indication that perhaps Leah and Rachel were co-conspirators. That Rachel was part of the deception. Might have been, might not have been. But we did say that one of the things, couple of the things that are going on here is that first, there was this big feast that he gave. We can expect that there was a lot of drinking, so he got Jacob drunk. The brides in those days were covered from head to foot in special wedding attire, covered with jewels and gold, very heavy. They had to be helped to get up, in fact. And then the bridal chamber was kept in total darkness. So the fact that he didn't realize he was sleeping with the wrong woman is not too strange. But in the morning he realizes the deception, and he says to Laban, and here's where the irony is so delicious. So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?" Jacob is in this place only because he deceived his brother Esau. And here he's complaining about being deceived. And Laban not only puts the knife in, but twists it. Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older. We respect," he says, "the rights of the older sibling. You built your life on trying to get ahead of your older brother, but in this place we respect the elder." It would be disrespectful of Leah to marry Rachel off first. But he says, "Don't worry. Just spend the honeymoon week with this one." He doesn't even call her by name. "And then we'll give you the other one if you work for another 7 years." And Jacob agreed. His love for Rachel was so overpowering that he's willing to work another 7 years to get the woman that he really wants.
So by that we can understand that it's also the practice in Canaan that the elder daughter would be married first, and Laban was just rubbing it in, saying,
"We don't know." Okay, we don't know. Don't know if this was really the case or if he was just using it as an excuse. Because we're going to find out very soon that Jacob is a good shepherd. Laban has been getting rich off of Jacob. Because riches at that time were measured as much in terms of how much livestock you had as how much gold you had. So whether it's really true or not, we don't know. But Laban certainly takes advantage of the situation. And then it says in verse 30, "And Jacob cohabited with Rachel also. Indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah." And this is the seed for the next round in the family story. Where did Jacob learn to play favorites? I'm sorry?
He was brought up to play
favorites. He was brought up that way. His father favored Esau. His mother favored him. Favoritism is the way he was brought up himself. So he follows his parents' pattern. How often do we see that in our own society? So it says he loves Rachel more than Leah. Doesn't say that he hated Leah. He just loved one more, and the whole family knew it. This is not something he kept to himself, as we'll see in a few minutes. So, yeah, how do we want to do this? All right, so what's the... At this point... Whether we believe this was from the 1800 or 1900 BCE or from 700 or 800 BCE, there was no concept of an afterlife at this time. That developed much later. Eternity was achieved through children, through sons especially, because the son carried on the name. Sons were how you obtained immortality. So the most important thing is to have children, have sons. And we saw that in the previous generations too. Sarah was so concerned about not having a son that she told Abraham to have a baby with Hagar. And Isaac, when confronted with Rebecca's inability to have children, prayed to God and then waited patiently for God to respond. The covenant depends on having children. God promised that your children will be great, both in terms of number and in terms of stature. So the next episode focuses on the descendants. And God is going to balance the scales. The author is going to put this in the hands of God directly. Would somebody like to read at verse 31?
I will.
Please.
When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son, and she named him Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has looked on my affliction, surely now my husband will love me.
Okay, now you have in Hebrew, all of these are puns. And we'll try to keep a scorecard here. So Leah has Reuben. In Hebrew, it reads, she named him Reuven because she saw. In Hebrew, saw is ra'ah, so Reuven is a combination of saw, and Ben is son. So it's a pun based on God has seen my affliction. It also but this name also tells you something about Leah's state of mind. She views her marriage as an affliction, but she wants Jacob to love her. She is, I don't know if devoted is too strong a word, but she is certainly tied to him, and she wants his love. Please, continue.
She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also, and she named him Simon.
Okay, Simon, in Hebrew that's Shimon, and in Hebrew, Shema is here. So she said, God has heard my prayer. God heard that I was in love. Ki Shama Adonai. So Shema became Shimon.
Again she conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be joined to me because I have borne him three sons. Therefore he was named Levi.
Okay, Levi. Now, Levi, that is also Yilaveh is the verb for attach. So Yilaveh becomes Levi. Remember, in Hebrew, it's the consonants that are important, not the vowels. Please, one more.
She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she named him Judah.
Okay.
Then
okay. So the and this also is a pun because in Hebrew. She says, "Hapa'am." This time, Odeh. So, in the Odeh becomes Yehuda, which is Judah. Now, you'll recognize some of these names already, because we know who. You're familiar with the Levites? Is that part of your tradition? They're the ones who became the caretakers of the sacrificial system. Moses was a Levite. And Judah later became the primary tribe among the 12. Okay, so Leah, the unloved one, has four sons right away. We have no idea how far apart these are, whether they're one right after another, whether there's time in between. The only concept of time we're given here is that Jacob will spend a total of 20 years with Laban. The first 7 years were working for his wife, so all of these children that we're going to hear about came about in 13 years. So, who's happy here?
Nobody.
Well, no, not quite. So there are some people who are happy. So who's happy here? Sir?
Well, I'm just wondering, so at this point he has two wives?
Two wives, yes.
Everybody's cool with that, except for Leah.
Well, there's the competition between the sisters, but polygamy was perfectly acceptable back then.
Okay.
No problem at all with that. Polygamy was
acceptable.
I'm sorry?
Just kind of a normal state of affairs.
Yes. In fact, we were talking before the session started in the Sephardic world, the world of Sephardic Jewry, which is North Africa and the Mediterranean area, that polygamy carried on into the 20th century, when the state of Israel was established and Jews were expelled from the North African lands like Algeria and Morocco, and then a little bit later when Jews were brought in from Yemen, many of them had multiple wives, and Israel had a hard time figuring out how to deal with that. The decision they made was that if they already had multiple wives, they could keep them, but no more, that would not be allowed anymore. So in Sephardic Jewry, that was permitted up until 50 years ago. Yes?
In all of this, we don't hear anything about Jacob at all. We don't know what his reaction to any of this was.
Very good. And who gives the names?
Leah
does, which is an important thing. Because remember, we talked last week, that the person who, maybe not, in the Bible, I hope I'm not repeating myself, in the Bible, names are not just labels. They say something about the essence of what's being named. Using a person's name gives you power over them. In the whole Bible, Jewish Bible, well, I shouldn't say that, in the five books of Moses, I can't say about that, I don't know enough about the rest of it to say specifically, in the whole five books of Moses, there are only two times that a person addresses another person by name. One of them is in the list of the antediluvians, where one of the people addresses his wives by name. And the other one is where Pharaoh calls Moses and Aaron by name. And in both of those cases, you can imagine that these are people who are, they're using the names to try to gain power over them. So giving a person a name, or giving anything a name, gave you power over that person. She is the one who gives the name.
I'm thinking that there have to be daughters born. So I'm thinking that in between these sons, there may have been daughters, and they just don't talk about them.
It's possible, but we will get a daughter named. There will be a daughter in a few minutes. So, maybe not.
From Leah? But not from Leah.
Yes, from Leah. From Leah. Dina will be the daughter. So who's happy here? Is anybody happy?
I don't know. But Jacob seems like he's got a good thing going.
Sure.
All his wives are giving him women, and he's having sons.
He's got Leah bearing sons, which is his immortality. And he's got Rachel, the one he really loves, who's still there for him. Now, the rules of polygamy are that a man owes each of his wives three things. He owes them sustenance. They have to be fed. He owes them, he must provide clothes for them, garments, and he must have sexual relations with them. So he is required to sleep with both of them in turn. So he's probably pretty happy. What about Leah? How do you think she feels? Is she happy or not? So, right. She's winning the competition with her sister. Very good. And there is this competition going on. So she's happy, but she's unhappy. Who's the least happy person? Rachel. Should she be the least happy? What do you think? What's the upside for Rachel?
That Jacob loves her more than her sister.
I'm sorry?
That Jacob loves her more than her sister.
She is the one that Jacob loves. She has her husband's love. And even Leah feels that she does not. But we can imagine that given this situation, she's not very happy. I'm sorry? Yes, but remember, she has a maid, and they are also they would have other servants as well, because he's part of Laban's family, and Laban is a rich is the leader of a very large and wealthy clan. That's going to change in a few minutes, but right now he's wealthy, so Jacob has the advantages of that.
I don't think we ever established whether Leah likes Jacob, loves Jacob, and she went in on a scheme to put Leah in her place on the way. Right. So she obviously wasn't so overwhelmed by her love for Jacob.
Well, we have to be careful. We don't know that she did that. That's only a possibility. But you're right. We talked about this last week, and I mentioned the book, The Red Tent, which some of you may have read, that tells the story from Rachel's point of view. We don't know whether she loved Jacob or not. But certainly by this point, at the very least, she's in competition with her sister. If nothing else, Leah's had four sons right in a row, and she's there with nothing. At least in her mind.
Do the commentators make anything out of the fact that God sided with Leah in this whole thing?
Well, God is trying to balance the scales. At least that's the way the author presents it to us. Leah is unloved or less loved, so she's the one who gets the kids. Okay, would somebody like to pick up now with chapter 30? Who would like to read it? Please. Chapter 30. Well, just start. We'll see where we get to.
Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children. She envied her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children, or I shall die." Jacob became very angry with Rachel and said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?"
Okay. Rachel says, "Give me children." And his response is to get mad at her. Why? He loves her. Why is he mad at her?
Well, he's saying, well, God's one, you know, that provides you with children. It's not okay. My fault.
And from what we're told, that's true. This is God's doing. But from his standpoint, why isn't he more sympathetic?
He's already got four sons.
His needs are met. He has four sons to carry on his name. He doesn't need any more. Besides which, we're told that Rachel was very pretty, and maybe he doesn't want her to lose her figure by giving birth to children. He's got the best of both worlds now. Yes?
You know, trouble with the idea that God is participating in all this deception. I mean, I guess my thought would be he would be looking on and saying, "Oh my gosh, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. These are my people. How are they?" And yet it appears he's participating.
Well, I don't know that I'd call this deception. Again,
well, how they all got there.
Well, that's how they react to the situation. But God presents him with the situation. Leah is unloved, so God is presented. God is trying to balance the scales. She doesn't have love, so she can have children. Now, is God being cruel by not giving Rachel children as well? We could debate that. There's a... It's hard to attribute characteristics to God. When we try to do that, we run into trouble. There was a Jewish scholar called Maimonides who lived in the middle of 1400s, 1500s. started in Spain, got kicked out, along with as a part of the Inquisition, wound up in the Middle East. He says you cannot make any positive statements about God. You cannot say God is good. You can't say God is kind, because that limits God to our definition of what's good and what's kind. He said all you can do is make negative statements about God. God is not cruel. But I don't even agree with that, because that does the same thing. That limits God to our definition of what's cruel. The God is completely beyond our understanding, in my view. So to make any statement positive or negative about God can get us into trouble, because it limits God to our concept of the words that we're using. So what you're saying is absolutely true, and we can wonder about this. But to try to say that God is participating in the deception, I don't think I'd agree with that. But God is certainly taking an active role in what's going on here. God is not absent. Even though they're in Haran, which is hundreds of miles away from Canaan, God is still an active participant. Okay, so now we get to, now we see how Rachel tries to solve her infertility problem. Please.
Then she said, "Here is my maid, Bilhah. Go into her, that she may bear upon my knees, and that I too may have children through her."
Okay, where have we seen this before? This is exactly what Sarah did. Does she know about this? Quite probably. It's family lore. I mean, this Sarah was her grand aunt. And of course, in those times, this is corresponding to surrogate motherhood. They're just having her idea is that Bilhah will have the child, and she will adopt it. It didn't work out too well for Sarah. Works out a bit better for her. Please.
So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob the son. Then Rachel said, "God has judged me and has also heard my voice and given me a son. Therefore, he named him Dan."
Okay, in Hebrew, Dan is a judge. So she says, "Yeah, God has judged me." Please.
Rachel's maid, Bilhah, conceived again and bore Jacob the second son. Then Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed." So she named him Naphtali.
Naphtali is, let me get the Hebrew for that. The word for that, Niftalti, I waged a struggle with my sister. So that's where Naphtali comes from. Notice now, unlike Sarah, Rebecca, and Hagar, where they only had one kid, Jacob has two with Bilhah, which means he's continuing to cohabit with her. She has now become a concubine. Her status is unclear. We had the same problem with Hagar. She used to be a maid. Now her status is less clear. She's not a full wife, but she's more than just a maidservant, because she's had children with Jacob. I'm sorry? To be a wife. What verse are you in?
Four.
So how does your version read?
And then she said, verse 3 begins, then she said, "Here's my baby Bilhah."
Right.
"Give her that she may bear upon my knee, that I too may have children fewer than four. So she gave him her maid, Philip, as a wife, and Jacob went into her.
Okay, so she gave she gave her maid Bilhah to Jacob as a wife. Right. Actually, the Hebrew would my version has concubine. The Hebrew would support wife.
Even though there was no marriage to speak of.
In those days, there were two things that were required for marriage. One is sexual relations. The other is the payment of a bride price. So they had sexual relations. Bride price, since she was already part of the family, that's where it becomes kind of iffy. But you're right. In Hebrew, the word is isha, which means isha's woman. She's his woman. Now that can mean wife, but in this case, it's more likely a concubine, not a full wife. A half wife. Okay, so now who's happy?
Rachel.
Is Rachel really happy, you think?
Well, she has to share Bilhah.
Okay. She's certainly happier than she was. Even though it's by a surrogate, she has provided her husband with some sons.
Mm-hmm. There was a film a number of years ago and a book. I wish I could remember it. Might have been The Red Tent.
Mm-hmm.
And they personified or they acted that out.
Yes. And in fact, as I understand, this was a recognized ritual. And what would happen is that the adopting mother would lie down first. The surrogate mother would lie on top of her. So when the child came out, it was almost as if it was coming out from the from Rachel's legs, from Rachel's body.
Hmm? That's interesting.
I'm sorry?
It's interesting.
Yes. and it makes much more sense in the context of the times than it would to us today. We look at this and we say, what's going on? But we have stranger things today. It's just that we're more used to them. So Rachel is happier, but not fully happy, I would guess. How's Jacob? Is he happy?
He's having a great time.
Now, on the other hand, he has three wives that he has to support. So now it's a three-way. He has to divide his nights three ways. So who's unhappy? Leah. In the contest, her competitor is gaining on her. So what's she going to do? Would you like to read? Yeah. Go ahead. Let's see. Where were we? Hang on. Let me get my glasses. Verse 9. God, okay, not God, but God. Gadim, what good fortune in the Hebrew? God is luck. So what good fortune? Please. I'll share. There's a. Asher is happy. Ashrei ha'am, happy is the people who have God who have Adonai as their God. Notice who's giving the names, though.
Leah,
and before it was Rachel who was giving the names. I didn't point that out before, but they're asserting their authority over these kids. By giving them the names. They're also, by implication, making sure that nobody thinks that Bilhah and Zilpah are full wives. Okay. So now who's happy?
Jacob.
Jacob is even happier. Except now he has four wives. And his calendar must be getting really complicated. I mean, he's out working in the fields all day, and then he's got to come in, and now he's got to keep four wives happy. This may not be the happiest home life either. He may not be as happy as we think he is. Unless he's completely oblivious to what's going on, which is quite possible. He just may not care about the rivalry between Leah and Rachel.
So were men clueless even back then?
I'm sorry?
Were men clueless even back then?
I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were. Okay, so now we have a strange little episode. Yeah, we're doing fine. Okay. Somebody else like to read? Or would you like to continue? Please. I'm sorry? Oh, would somebody else like to read? All right, you're nominated. Go ahead. Okay, now we've got to need to understand this. First of all, who is Reuben? Reuben is the firstborn. He's the oldest in the family. He's later going to be disgraced, and we should know this. Later he's going to sleep with his father's concubine. He's going to sleep with Bilhah. So he'll become disgraced. But he goes out and finds some mandrakes. Mandrakes were thought at that time to be a fertility. Medicine is not the right word. They would not an aphrodisiac, a fertility medicine, that they would help someone get pregnant. This was a cure for barrenness. An aphrodisiac makes you want sex more. This has to do with the results of the sex, make it successful in terms of having children. So the mandrakes are connected with fertility. And I'm not sure about this. I've heard that the mandrakes, when they are kind of, they're roots, like carrots, except they're fragmented. So often they look like bodies. They have arms and legs and things like that. And you can see, the people thought that's what the connection was. And this is a very revealing statement that she makes. Leah certainly is not happy with Rachel. You've taken away my husband. She is not happy with what her father has done in tricking Jacob into marry both of them. And she says, was it not enough that you took away my son, my husband? I mean, she was the first wife. She's the one who was married first. Please. So she trades her night with Jacob for what she thinks will get her the child that she wants. Please. What irony. All Rachel wants is to have a child, and she trades away her night, and what happens? Her rival gets another son. So the effect is just the opposite of what she intended. Please. Issachar. Shachar in Hebrew is a salary. It's a wage. So she said, God has given me my wages for what I have been going through. Zebulon. And let me hang on here. I'm not finding the pun, but it's a pun on exalting, Yisbaleni, Zavulon. Now we come to Dina. Okay. Okay, and Dina will become important next week. All right, so. Jacob is probably even happier because he has more sons. Leah is happier because she is back into the birthing business. And Rachel is left out in the cold again. It's the tension in this household must have been unbelievable. Swinging back and forth between one and the other. And Jacob, again, just doesn't seem to... Well, we hear nothing about Jacob in all of this. He just does what his wives tell him.
He probably stays out in the fields.
Maybe he works a lot of overtime.
Would they have all lived in the same house?
Probably not. They were probably... Each of the wives would probably have their own tent. So it would be you could imagine this as an encampment, with the each of the wives having their own tent, and because remember a tent would not have rooms, I mean just one room, and the servants would have their own tents. They would have families with their own facilities, their own living places. So you can imagine this as a compound, rather than one huge tent where they all lived. Okay, so finally, Rachel gets what she's been after. Somebody read.
Then God remembered Rachel, and God tended her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son, and she said, God has taken away my reproach. And she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord have me another son.
Okay, Yosef in Hebrew means to add. To add. So she finally has a son, and what does the name she gives him express? I want more. I want more. Just one isn't enough. The unfulfilled longing expressed in that name. It is very deep. Okay, so this is the way the situation is going to sit for a while. At this point, Jacob has 11 sons and one daughter. And he has one wife that he loves more than another, and he has two secondary wives, two concubines. Now, all this happened within the space of 13 years. There's an important concept, at least in the Jewish view of this part of the Bible. The rabbis say there's no before and after. This is not necessarily chronological. What we're going to read now is going to take place in the 14th year. So this may have been before all those children were born, Or it may have been after. We just don't know. It's hard to squeeze. It's hard to see how you can squeeze all those kids into 14 years. Even 20 years is a stretch. But the especially if they came in the sequences described. But the so at this point, 14 years have gone by. Jacob has fulfilled his debt to Laban for the two marriages. Would you like to continue? Good.
Oh, okay. When Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives, my children, from whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know very well the service I have given you."
We're now going to find out that Jacob has been a very good shepherd, which is one of the things that we will need to look at as we go through, and especially when next week when we get to the return, is how Jacob has changed in this story. We heard very little about him in this whole begotting sequence. He was almost absent, except that he was the instrument of the begetting. But he had no voice. The voices were all the voices of the women. But he has been working for Laban, so all the flocks that he has helped grow, none of them belong to him. He's as penniless now as he was when he arrived, except that he now has 12 kids to support and 4 wives. Okay, please.
But Laban said to him, "If you will allow me to say so, I have learned from the nation that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages, and I will give it." Jacob said to him, "You yourself know how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly. And the Lord has blessed you wherever I come."
Okay, now Laban, this is kind of a mix here. Laban invokes God, the God of Abraham, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but he mixes in other things too. "I have learned by divination." So while Laban respects Jacob's God, it's not clear that he has adopted Jacob's God as his own. Because in later times, divination would be expressly forbidden.
But now, when shall I provide for my own household also? He said, "What shall I give you?" Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this for me, I will again feed your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all of your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb and the spotted and the speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come to look into my wages with you. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and the black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen." Laban said, "Good, let it be as you have said."
Okay, so now we have to, this sounds a little bit puzzling, and I must admit I have to keep rethinking about this. This is in we're getting into the realm of genetics now. What he's saying is, what Jacob is saying is, that I will take all of the sheep that are not, the sheep and goats that are not solid colored. Now, if you remember your genetics, when you talked about peas and things like that in junior high school, if you have two white sheep that mate, most likely they will have white offspring. But there is a genetic possibility that they will have a colored one if they have a recessive gene that's dark. Okay? But if two very colored sheep mate, it is highly unlikely that they'll have a solid color offspring. It's like 1 in 4, most 1 in 4, if they have if the two recessive genes have to come together. So Jacob is saying, I will take all of the model very colored animals, and you keep all the solid colored ones. And when the solid colored ones that are in your in your flock, they mate. If they have a very colored one, then that'll be mine. And if you find a solid colored one in my flock, then that got there by theft, and that's yours. And this would appeal to Laban because it's no zero cost to him at this point. It all is in the future. But that same day, is verse 35, but that same day he, that is Laban, removed the streaked and spotted he-goats and all the speckled and spotted she-goats, every one that had white on it, and all the dark-colored sheep, and left them in charge of his sons, and he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Laban's flock. Now, it's unclear to me whether at this point Laban is really cheating Jacob. It could be that he is, because these are the solid, the speckled ones were the ones that were supposed to be Jacob's wages, and he's taking them out and sending them away. But on the other hand, Jacob said, pay me nothing. In the future, this is what I will take. So it's not clear to me whether this is something that, whether those spotted ones that are in the current generation of animals were supposed to be Jacob's or not. But it might have been, in which case Laban is already beginning to cheat on the deal. This next, just bear with me. This next sounds strange, but it will be explained next week. Would somebody like to read the rest of the chapter? Go
ahead. Jacob, however, took fresh cuts, branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees, and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in the heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. Thus he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. So the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks. And maidservants and manservants and camels and donkeys.
Okay, now we'll get an explanation of this later on, but basically at this point all we know is that Jacob found a way to induce the flocks to have the kind of sheep and goats that would be his. He could induce them to have the very colored animals. But he went beyond that in choosing only the weakest not to have very colored animals. So the ones that Laban got not only were fewer, they were less sturdy.
God must have been involved.
Yes, and we'll find out about how God was involved next week. So come back next week and hear the next part of the story, because there's a lot more to do. We have two more sessions, and we certainly want to get through Jacob's encounter with Esau when he returns. But I think our time is up now. So thank you, and I hope to see you again next week.
Thank you.